Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to episode 4 of our Black Pioneer series in celebration of Black History Month. Tonight is Windrush, and along with our usual suspects, there's my co-host Dave Bowler. Good evening, David.
Evening. Evening, one and all. It's good to be back on this one. The series is going nicely. I think this one's going to be even better.
It is, you know, a magnificent series, but this one, you know, I think in particular was the one that stood out on the list. To me, no disrespect to any of them, you know, they're all brilliant episodes, but yeah, this was the one that was, you know, the keenest to get to, shall we say. And also welcoming our spirit guides, the co-authors of Football's Black Pioneers, the stories of the first black players to represent the 92 league clubs that was released in 2020, Bill Hearn and David Gleave. Good evening, Bill and David.
Hi, it's great to be back.
It is. It's great to be back in harness.
Always enjoy these chats. Nice to see you again.
They are good. Yes, we most enjoy this. Most definitely. And a special guest again tonight. We've been lucky enough. Bill has managed to hook in the marvellous Brenton Phillips as well, who is along for the ride tonight. Now, Brenton, if you're not familiar with him, he started out at Coventry Boys. He was on the books at Leicester City. He played for Peterborough United, Mansfield Town, Brighton and Hove Albion, and also at non-league level with Nuneaton Borough, Kettering, Scarborough and Aylesbury, which we will come to as part of the evening as well. There was an interesting game with Aylesbury at one point. As well as that, he branched into management with Bedworth, Stafford and Nuneaton at Hales Own as well, where he was chief executive. So Brenton brings a lot of experience to the table, and so many facets that we have spoken in previous episodes of black footballers, and you know, we've spoken about how black players have become part of the fabric of football, but black managers still hit a cul-de-sac, and even more so in the boardroom. Welcome, Brenton, and thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I actually feel quite honoured to be sort of in this kind of company. I've read some of the episodes. I've seen some of the stuff that you've put out. It's absolutely marvellous. I'm happy to share my experiences from my humble level of non-league. I think it's varied, as you've just said, and the Windrush generation resonates certainly with myself, because my parents were part of that generation when they came from Jamaica over to England way back when. And I'm happy and delighted to be able to contribute to this this episode.
Oh, thank you so much, Brenton. We are looking forward to this so much. Bill and David, now give us some background. Take us through Windrush and, you know, the absolutely everything that it represents.
Well, I mean, I'm guessing that everybody on this call and people listening will know a fair amount about the Windrush. I mean, it's become a name that everybody's familiar with. It's actually the name of the ship that brought, I think it was 1,027 passengers to England in June 1948. There's a lot of myths and misunderstandings about the nature of the people who were on the ship, which Bill is in a much better position to elaborate on than I am, because he's done a huge amount of research into who those passengers were and what became of them. But the Windrush was only one ship. There had been ships before that. There was a ship called the Ormond, I think, which landed in Liverpool. There was one called the Almanzora, which landed in Southampton. Both of those predate the Windrush. Somehow they've never quite caught the public imagination the same way. And of course, there were many, many ships after the Windrush. The Windrush itself made only the one journey. So there were lots of others that also brought immigrants from, or not immigrants really, people from the Caribbean to England. I hesitate over the use of the word immigrant because, of course, they were British citizens. So it was just like moving from the Orkney Islands, really. They were entitled to be here as anybody else. So if I ever use the word immigrant, slap me down, because they were. But you know, it was the people that came, the people on the ship themselves went on to have fascinating lives, which Bill knows about. But I mean, it's the people that came afterwards. I mean, I've always said that, you know, we wouldn't really have an NHS today if it hadn't been for the nurses that came over from the Caribbean to build the NHS. Many, many of the Windrush generation, you know, helped to run the railways, helped to run the post office, helped to run the London buses in particular. So they helped support every facet of British life. And the Windrush generation, that generation, really covers everybody who came from the Caribbean up to, I think it was 1972, at which stage the various bits of anti-immigration laws, the various law changes were made to stop people coming, really, or to make it much, much, much harder for people to come. So there was that window of opportunity, if you like, from 1948 through till the 1970, I think 71 or 72, when a large numbers of people from the Caribbean came. The Windrush was the first ship probably that brought a large number. There had been ships before that, but the Windrush perhaps is generally reckoned to be the start of a sort of mass migration from the Caribbean to England. You can argue about that, but broadly speaking, I think that's a fair summary. It's the people that came after. I mean, some of the people we'll talk about tonight came during that period between the 48 and 72, or if they didn't, their parents did.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add really is that I was trying to think of a typical Windrush story, and there isn't actually a typical one. I mean, one thing I can see is there were no footballers on the Windrush. There were boxers. There were several boxers on board, about five or six. There was a cyclist, but we haven't found any footballers. But as I said, there's no typical Windrush. I mean, Brett Brenton, for example, his mum and dad came across and left him and his sister in Jamaica while they set up home. And we heard the other week that Roland Butcher was in a similar position. Somebody like Viv Anderson, his dad came across. He was already married to Myrtle, his wife. He came across in 54, I think it was, set up home to not. His wife came across a year later. Probably the most common one is that people came across on the Windrush with the intention of making some money, working hard, 5 years' time, go back to the West Indies, and, you know, they'd be set up for life. And what invariably happened was they met a woman, and married, and ended up staying in England for a lot longer than they'd originally planned. Lloyd Maitland is a good example of that one, but there were a lot of mixed marriages, because, of course, there weren't many black women in England. It was very much male-dominated on the Windrush. Equally, there's an example, the first black player to play for Harrogate, Denver Mitchell. His father was in the RAF. He came across from the West Indies in the RAF and didn't go back. And after the war, he married a German nurse, which must have been a very difficult situation immediately after the war. So I would say there's probably no typical Windrush story, even though when we set out, we thought there would be a lot of similarity between the various characters.
Dave Bowler, the Windrush generation, you know, a deep impact, not just in football terms, but in, you know, just in society across the board.
Yeah, massive impact on what David says about the NHS in particular. I think he's absolutely spot on. And, you know, I think all, I use the phrase in inverted commas, civilised nations, the tribes, I think, will inevitably rely on some form of migration to power developments like an NHS, or to work a transport network or things like that. It's a monumental contribution. And of course, obviously, the Windrush scandal has been the thing that we've been talking about now for, I don't know, what, 5-10 years or whatever it is. An absolute abomination that any country could have allowed that to happen. And of course, having learned absolutely nothing from that, we're now doing it with a different group of migrants from other parts of the world now. I mean, you know, it's just a tragedy that we don't seem to learn from anything. And we just repeat the same mistakes over and over again.
Indeed we do. I mean, Brenton, I mean, your, you know, early experiences, and I mean, you as I think it was David or Bill mentioned, you know, you were over here at the age of six, you know, your own memories of, you know, those early days?
Yeah, my earliest memory, Steve, was like mum and dad. Well, dad came first as part of that generation. And then sent for my mum. They're both deceased now, obviously. But myself and my sister Beverly were left in a rural village near Linstead, which is in the centre of St. Catherine in Jamaica. Spanish Town is probably the nearest place, which is down the road. And, you know, we went to live with Gran. And gradually they made a foothold in the UK. My dad was a qualified tailor, and he had his own business, and he made the jackets, and my cousin made the trousers. So we sort of clothed everybody in the village that they lived in. And he came to England with the grand idea that he was going to become this tailor and so on, and do what he was doing there and establish a successful business. That never happened. The reality was he ended up working in a company called GEC in Coventry, which, you know, it worked shift hours on nights and everything else. My cousin, who he'd sent for after a few years of being here, who's now back in Spanish Town in Jamaica, he got a job on the railway. And he worked, like the guys have said previously, he worked on the railways for years. My mother worked in the NHS, and they eventually were able to send for me and Beverly to come and join them. And we flew up here on an aircraft called a BOAC. If you go on the Cathay Pacific reels, you'll see them. And you often think back and think, well, how did that get from Kingston, Jamaica to the UK? And we came up. I was six. My sister was eight, and we travelled up with somebody that was going to be eventually based in Birmingham, and we travelled to Gatwick Airport. Never ever forget it. Father was there to greet us and pick us up with another guy from. By this time, they'd settled in Coventry, and it was absolutely freezing. I've never seen snow in my life. I didn't even know where we were going. It was like such an experience. It was ridiculous. I didn't want to come because I hid under a bed when they sent the low loader to take us to Kingston Airport. I went and hid in the neighbor's bedroom. But once we got here and we got to Coventry, I can remember saying to my sister, well, are these things factories? Because all we could see was rows of terraced houses. And I'd never seen any in my life because we lived on a small holding in the country. We'd never seen properties joined together and jitters and things like that. And it was really, really strange. You know, 6 years old, it was like you're terrified, really. We established ourselves as a family in Coventry. You could remember signs on the various doors where people were looking for lodgings, and there was the usual ones, no Irish, no dogs, no black, all that kind of stuff was there. But we were fortunate. We actually fell into a street where my best friend was an Irish guy, my next best friend was an Italian, and we sort of formed a bond together, and the rest of it is like history, you know. I'd never kicked a ball. I'd never, ever seen a football in my life until I came to England. Didn't even know what the game was about. And the Irish guys and the Italian guys that I hung around with taught me how to play football, which isn't bad. I managed to develop the career that I had. I mean, it's not on the sort of Viv Anderson level or whatever, but I mean, I remember playing against those guys, and I eventually signed for Leicester City, and young Cyril Regis emerged at Hayes to start with, and then he made his big breakthrough. Laurie Cunningham was always a big idol of mine because he was at Orient at the time. There was a black guy who played for Wolverhampton Wanderers called Don Gardner that I always loved watching Don play. I don't think he made that many first-team appearances or if he did make any, but we used to play against him in the youth team and in the A team, you know, over at Castlecroft at Wolves. And so, marvellous memories, Bob Hazel and these sort of guys, they all became sort of contemporaries and heroes of mine, even though I didn't sort of hit that, you know, that level of recognition in Leicester City, in the first teams and all of that. I think the career that I've enjoyed, I've made so many friends and, you know, it's been absolutely fantastic all over the country. And think back to those days, Steve, you know, when, how does that equate to where you've got to now, ending up playing for the England non-league side and managing quite successfully in the then conference and being elected as a manager of the year when the league won the Midland Division, Premier Division by, I don't know, 24 points or something. And I remember going down to, I think it was Café Royal in London, and being presented with a trophy by the then Minister of Sport was a lady called Kate Howie, I think it was. My mum and my dad and my family were that proud. It's just like, you can't sense it, can you? You know, you come out of Cashel Walk in Linstead in Jamaica, and you end up in the same room as the British Minister for Sport, who's giving you a gong saying you're now the manager of the year. You're a black guy. There's no black managers in the league at that point, and very few since. And probably we'd have the conversation the next 10 years, there'll still be very few. I've done loads of them in the past. Radio Leicester have done stuff with me about, you know, the lack of black management and representation and all that. So, you know, you're still fighting a battle, but a lot of people have given up that battle. Do you know what I mean? A lot of the guys have given that up and have gone into the media or doing whatever, because there is an unequal playing field in terms of the distribution of managerial positions for ethnic minorities and whatever they are. That's just a fact. And the ones that do really well, like, you know, Vincent Kompany's doing fantastic at the minute, and you've had others that have had their period in the sun. At the end of the day, there's not enough of them. But it's getting better, I think. It is getting better. Certainly on the playing side, things are getting better and all that. But in the boardroom side of it, after the days are over, when your career's gone, but you love the game and you want to get into the game as a manager, you want to put something back in at that top level, or, you know, the elite level or just below, it's always very difficult as a black person to attain that. It's just what it is. We'll continue to work. I wouldn't say it's like, you know, people are prejudiced, but it's like this ingrained thing that it's very easy to get. I mean, look at what's happened to Darren Moore. I was at Wembley a few months ago, and absolutely had the best day of my life. I took my grandchild down there, the Lawson, who you've just seen, Kelvin, my son, went down with me. We were in the Wednesday end. We got some great tickets, and they won on the day. They got through, didn't want penalties. Josh Windus scored the goal. And about 4 or 5 weeks later, Darren's gone. And I'm thinking, hold on a minute. What's that about? What is all that about? It must have been a decision that was made prior. Because after the Peterborough game, when they got absolutely spanked at Peterborough in the first leg, he got so much vitriolic abuse on social media. It was criminal. My son and myself told Bill this when I met with Bill the other week. And I said, my son had rang me up and he said, are we going to go up, Dad, on the Friday for the game, the return leg? And I said, look, Cal, there is absolutely no way I'm going to go up there, because if they're not 3-0 up or 4-0 up, the place is going to turn vitriolic, because there's going to be a massive crowd. There always is. So we decided to watch it on the television. And the rest is this. I mean, we all probably seen the game. Some of you guys may have. We got through to Wembley with Jack Hunt's penalty. And I thought, oh, Christ, this is just a roller coaster ride. Because, I mean, 6 weeks before that particular game, I'd been up to the Morecambe game. And if Wednesday had won that game, they'd have gone at sort of 8 points clear or something daft, with three games in hand on Plymouth and Ipswich. So Darren's fate for me must have been sealed, not at Wembley, but before. When they actually pulled the miracle and got there, what reason is there, unless it was something within the club, I don't know, would you want to make that change? And they're the kind of things that resonate with me and knock me still. Because Darren's a good man, and he's had to endure a lot of stuff, came through it, and then got the sack. Well, not got the sack, mutually departed, whichever they want to put it. After getting a team promoted that's been away from the Premier League for over 20 years, you know, massive club, massive fan base, great supporters. And you think, yeah, well, who'd want to go manage there? It's one of those, isn't it?
I mean, Bill and David, we've spoken a few times of Darren Moore and the situation with Darren Moore. It doesn't make common sense in that respect. Brenton's nailed it absolutely there. Column A, it's his departure from Sheffield Wednesday. In the first place, it's column B, the fact that, you know, what he has just achieved or recently achieved, and that amazing comeback, you know, that amazing league season to start with, where, you know, three tried to condense into two for automatic promotion, with so many high points, that amazing comeback from the against Peter in the semi-final, the victory at Wembley. This is the high signals.
It signals, because the guy who Darren, sort of the Barnsley guy, Nick Duffy, I think he was at Cheltenham when I played, Michael Duff, who did a grand job at Barnsley, didn't get promotion, you know, whatever, beat Wednesday twice, lovely, they're up the road and lovely, 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 but didn't make the big prize. He gets a job at, I think he's gone to Swansea or something, isn't he? Yeah, I mean, Darren will resurface somewhere, hopefully. But it just left a poor taste with a lot of people, the way it sort of panned out. I'm still a supporter of the club. I still want them to do well. I'll still go and watch them this season. But it did leave a bit of a poor taste as a man of colour to hear and see and be in the stadium when you hear some of this stuff that is thrown out to somebody like Darren. Which, I don't know, how do you stop that?
I think one of the biggest injustices, and you're too modest to say so, I'm sure, Brenton, but at one point you took Nuneaton Borough to the top of the Conference League. To say it was on a shoestring would be putting it mildly. You had about 10 years' experience. You were still in your 40s. If that had happened today and it had been a white manager, I reckon every club in League One and League Two would be looking to appoint you. And you just never got that break, did you?
No, it was a marvellous time, Bill. You know, when I took the job there at Nuneaton, when I got the job, it was I'd been previously at Stafford Rangers, which was my first big break, really. They were in the Nationwide Conference at the time, and I'd been managing Bedworth. And we played them in an FA Cup game at the Oval at Bedworth, and we did reasonably well because, I mean, they were big favourites. We were total underdogs, but I had a decent side. And I think we may have got a draw, went back down to Marsden Road, and I think they probably nicked it or something. But we, over the two games, we were probably the better side. Dennis Booth, who's a friend of mine now, Dennis was the then manager of Stafford. And Dennis had a job offer. I think he went to Bristol Rovers. Bristol Rovers or somewhere like that had come for Dennis. And the chairman there then at the time, John Orton, brother of ex-Man City manager Brian Orton, rang me up and invited me down for an interview and so on. And for me, it was like a fabulous opportunity because, you know, I mean, Bedworth were in the old Western or Midland division and Stafford were in the Conference. And a very well-supported club and had a good history. They'd been to Wembley two or three times in the FA Trophy, got a decent fan base. Went down, was offered an opportunity, and, you know, I took it. And I had some decent times at Stafford, but the job I always really wanted was Nuneaton because I'm a Coventry-raised lad just down the road. Been at Bedworth, and that was my roots, that was my area, and I really wanted that job. It never came available. When it did come available, I'd been sacked at Stafford. I was out of work and stuff, and it was an opportunity for me to go and speak to the Borough, who, you know, outside of Gov City in that area, were probably the biggest team. And it was fantastic, Bill, because they were in the Midland Division playing in front of audiences of, I don't know, 600, Max. They've got a massive stadium, old iconic Manor Park, all that business. And I can remember saying it was whoever can push this boulder up the hill and get it to the top and let it go, you wouldn't be able to stop it. You know, it will just keep rolling and rolling and rolling and rolling. And we managed to take the club to that zenith and pushed it over. And then it has to stop. It has to stop somewhere. Because what happened, the gates went from 600 to an average of nearly 2,500. We got to the conference. We'd won the Premier League by record points, all that nonsense. And after about 19 games, first season in the old Vauxhall or Nationwide Conference, we sat at the top of the league or near the top of the league behind the likes of Kidderminster and Woking and all them with Jeff Chappell and Jan Molby and all these established names. And we were beating them. But the lads who had done brilliantly, the lads had done absolutely fantastically for the last couple of seasons. We needed reinforcements. We needed to say thanks, but no thanks, guys. You've taken us as far. And it was a difficult time for me to go into the boardroom and say, look, you know, some of these established favourites, we need to get them gone and bring fresh legs in if we are going to compete. And it never happened. And that's a disappointment thing. And when you get the sack, because at the end of that season, we really struggled. We were top of the league for nearly half of the season. And then we had to sort of scrap like hell to stop in the league. We managed to do that just. And if the season was in reverse order, you come up 13 years away from the top flight, you struggle for the first half of the season. You blitz the second half. I don't get the sack the season after when we have a bad start. It don't happen. And that is the bitterness that was in me when I left Dunedin. Because if you can encapsulate the results, the performances, the money that was made, the Malcolm Christie transfer money, the Andy Ducrome money and all of this kind of stuff, the rising gates and revenue and everything else, It's a good story. And yes, they may well have been. If it happened today, there may well be people who say, oh, yeah, well, he's a good manager. He's potentially a league manager. We'll go and talk to him. The only other one I ever bumped into back in them days was a guy called Mike McKenzie, who managed, one of the teams up north, the Manchester team, Hyde or somewhere like that. He managed Mike, and I became quite friendly with Mike at the time. I can't really remember any others back in them day. Keith Alexander came after, and Keith, bless him, he's gone now, rest his soul. Great, great friend of mine, became very friendly with Keith over the years. But I can't really remember too many others at that point, at that time. People ask me about it and I'm thinking, well, what can you say? I mean, results are results, aren't they? And football's football, and you get the sack. You know, all managers are going to get it someday. But it's one of them. You just think, well, it was the way it happened that was bitter. That's the way it happened. But, you know, and it did scar me for a while. I have to admit that. But you have to move on in life and get on and build that resilience to go again. And when we did that, I did that. And like I said to Bill the other week, the happiest times of my managerial career was at Elso in town. You know, smaller club than Dunedin, but the best people I've ever worked with. Fantastic supporters, lovely little ground. I've become an honorary black country guy. And I'll never forget, we had a game in the trophy, I think, against Canvey Island at Elso in 1 year, and we played Canvey Island and they bought a few and I think I always a draw or whatever it was. Gone into the Yelts bar after the game, and there was a group of Elzoin supporters sat in the corner with a group of Canvey Island guys. And I can tell you this, guys, I couldn't understand a word either of them were saying. The accents. I don't know how they understood each other. You've got the broadest black country accents, and you've got the deepest, I don't know, Cockney or Southern accents. And yet they were conversing. Great, having a pint together. Fantastic. I said to my missus, can you understand what these guys are talking about? But that's the joy of non-league, isn't it? And yeah, great times.
Absolutely, absolutely. David Gleave, Brenton's experiences that he's spelt out there, there is a common theme, isn't there? Darren Moore, we've spoken in the past of Chris Kamara, of Chris Hughton, of kind of like bringing a club to the door, going through, a door and into the next division, and then the harsh treatment that comes, that step further. It's there's an identikit pattern almost at play.
Yeah, and the thing that struck me as Brenton was speaking really was the thought about second chances. I mean, we all could name a whole string of white managers who go from job to job, get the sack, get another job, get the sack, get another job. You know, they get handsome payoffs each time. They make a career out of getting sacked, really. They seem to have no trouble getting another job. And you think to yourself, well, okay, why is that happening to him when somebody like, Chris Kamara or Viv Anderson as well, of course, was a manager for a while, or Brenton at the non-league level. Why are these people not getting that second chance? It's very difficult to think of any explanation that isn't based on race, to be honest. And I think it does come back to a point we've touched on before about a black presence in the boardroom. People people do tend to recruit in their own image.
Yeah.
So, if you're exclusively white boardroom and perhaps you don't have any or many black mates, you're going to tend to recruit a white manager. And I think we have talked about before on previous sort of discussions that it needs to change at the boardroom level. And once you begin to get more of a black presence at the boardroom, then you might begin to see a change, at the managerial level. But I mean, it's very difficult to see where that change in the boardroom is going to come from. I mean, I'm not sure how many sort of black executives Les Ferdinand comes to mind, but a QPR, but I couldn't name any others. I mean, probably you're better informed than I am, but until you get the change at that level, I'm not sure you're going to get change lower down.
Yeah. I think you're 100% right there, David, to be honest with you, because I don't think the problem is on the managerial side. The problem that needs fixing or addressing is the decision-making side and the boardroom side and the profile of people that are in these positions. Then normally they used to be the local richest businessman, the butcher, the candlestick maker, or whoever it was when I started at Leicester City, house builder or whatever. They got a few bob and they got themselves on the board at Leicester City or wherever else. That was the norm back in the day. Nowadays, it's entirely different. You've got these super rich people from all over the globe that sort of acquire a football club and they'll put some director of football or some operations director in. And they're invariably people that they'll know. Or people have been recommended for them to them. And then they've got the say. They'll then appoint a manager that they know or whatever, and so on and so on. So the Les Ferdinands of this world, they're an exception. They're not the rule. I mean, he's where he is at QPR because that's where he made his name. And he's there. You've got Mark Bright, who sits next to Steve Parish down at Crystal Palace every time, and he's sort of well respected there because he played for the Palace. But what actual influence they have on appointing managers is probably questionable, I would guess, and that's where the issue is. We don't have enough presence in that level as people of ethnic minorities. At this moment in time, it might change. You might find a Caribbean billionaire might turn up and buy a club, and all of a sudden he appoints whoever he appoints. But I mean, that's where the issues are, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, we have spoken about this before. It's the, I don't know, the black players have become so synonymous. We mentioned this earlier in the podcast, but black players, accepted on the pitch. It's the rarity of a black manager in the dugout, and the utter scarcity of black faces in boardrooms. I mean, within that, Brenton, give us an insight of your experiences as a chief executive as well, please.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did a role as chief exec at Elzone for a short period of time, really, and that was really because the club was going through a traumatic stage at that point, and they found or sourced a new owner, a guy who used to play for Luton, in Godfrey Ingram. And Godfrey was a really nice guy, nice man. He was based in America, and he got his brother involved. And I got a call from Kirk Stevens, who was a mate of mine and still is a mate of mine. And he played with me in the Luton Borough. And he later played for Luton Town with some distinction, Cov City. And Kirk rang me and he said, look, Godfrey, he played with Godfrey at Luton. And he said, look, would you be interested in meeting Godfrey and Graham Ingram? They're buying Elzowin. They're buying into Elzowin. Obviously, I'd been there as a manager previously, knew the club, had a lot of affection for it. So I met them. I met Godfrey and Graham, well, met Graham down in Bedford. And Godfrey was in America, and then he came over. And yeah, I mean, I took that challenge on, and they sort of said, look, you'll need to reshape the club and sort of be that presence. And I did that, thoroughly enjoyed it, to be honest with you. Revamped a lot of things down there, got some new sponsors on board and all that kind of stuff. But then it started to become a bit of a circus because it wasn't about the football club. It was about what the spin-offs from the football club and, acquiring land and building houses and building this, that, and the other somewhere else, using the football club as a vehicle for those opportunities to be opened. And it quickly turned sour for me because I'm not that kind of person. And in the end, when they started turning up in helicopters and landing helicopters in the middle of the pitch, it became a bit like a Fred Karno's situation. This is Elzo in town. This is a club in the middle of the Black Country, down in the Black Country, used to attract in 600, 700, 800 loyal local people, come and enjoy the game, win, lose, or draw, go into the Yelts bar, have a pint, drown your sorrows, enjoy your victories, put on some decent hospitality for the opposing fans and directors. That's what we were about. And that started to change. And it was at that point that, I just my values and my principles wouldn't let me stay involved in that. But at the experience of running the club as a chief executive for that short period of time gave me insight and gave me some good experience of what it was like on the other side. We had Matty Clark as the manager. Matty was a man of colour. He was great. We had Luke Moore, ex-West Brom player who played up front, who's miles too good for that level, Luke, but we managed to get him on board. And, it was very, very successful. We had a mixed race team, some great camaraderie there and some great fans. But, the fans deserved better than what was being served up. Because essentially, they were trying to sell the football club and build something on it. And that was behind the old lot, and that's not what I signed up for, so I left.
I mean, a lot of politics behind the scenes, by the sound of it. What was your experience of walking into other boardrooms, around the league?
Well, it was all right. It weren't too bad for me at that point because at the level that we were at, I was probably known in most of them. Whether or not the conversation or whatever else were genuine, but I knew most people. If we went and played, I don't know, Stourbridge, wherever, Bedford, wherever we went to play, the chances are walking into a boardroom, somebody go, oh, hello, Brenton, how are you? Well, yeah, whatever, bum, bum, bum. That's probably not because they know me. It's probably because they know the career that I'd had up to that point. And it weren't too bad. And I met some really nice people, to be quite honest with you. You soon get to know, you soon know the people that are have got that edge, or that if you're walking around in this skin, you it's quite easy to spot, to know people who keep the distance or look at you in a certain way or whatever, or shun the opportunity to make conversation. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to pick that out. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, but fortunately for me, it didn't happen too often, but it does exist. And this conversation could go on forever and ever and ever. And it's been going on for years. It's a multicultural game. There's a big presence in the game of ethnic minority people, black people, and a lot of Asian people coming into the game now as well. And you can talk about the next 20 years. Next 20 years, Steve, and we'll still be having the same conversation, in my view, you know, because it's predominantly what happens in the boardroom and the decision-making levels above that affect that change. All these great black players who have had stellar, outstanding careers that can't get jobs, they lose interest in the end. You know, some of them are fortunate, they get a job, they get sacked, and then they don't get another job. And then we have the same conversation over and over again. But if we had a 92 league clubs and 60 of them were managed by black people, there'd be a different landscape, wouldn't it? But I'm not saying that should happen automatically. It should never happen automatically. But there should be more opportunities and chances given to people of colour within this game of football at those kind of levels. Not positive discrimination, because a lot of these guys have had marvellous careers and they know the game inside out. They've got loads to offer, but they never seem to get an opportunity.
Absolutely, absolutely. Dave Bowler, you know, we've spoken of a similar theme in previous episodes about the experience and the knowledge that has been lost over the years through black players not being able to break into coaching spheres. I mean, Brenton brings an incredible cross section of experience there, from pulling on his boots to picking the team sheet to being in the boardrooms there, that is quite unique.
It is, yeah. I mean, we have talked about this at Infinitum in the previous episodes. I mean, when Brenton was talking about his experience as a manager and going to the CAFI role and picking up Manager of the Year, and that, I mean, I know it's not a direct comparison, but I was thinking of Steve Evans, Boston and Crawley and all of that. He ends up as Leeds United manager on a similar levels of success that Brenton had in non-league.
I can tell you a story, but Steve, I've known Steve for years. I know Steve when Steve was managing at Stamford and I was at Nuneaton. He rang me up, Steve, and he said, look, I'm looking for some reinforcements. I've got a couple of players that I needed to offload it at the time. One was a lad called Ian King, who hadn't really, I loved Ian King as a player, but he hadn't really settled in at Nuneaton, the ex-VS rugby player. And a lad called Richard Bailey, little black lad. We used to call him Riddick because he looked like Riddick Bowe, the boxer, and he was a little stocky striker. And so I met Steve at a halfway hour pub on the A47 out of Leicester down towards Peterborough, a place called Outton on the Hill. I did a deal to exchange, and he took these two players off me. And they went and did very well for Steve down at Stamford, and he did reasonably well there. And because I'd got ex-Boston connections, played for Boston United, their job came available. And John Blackwell, who was the then secretary, rang me up and he said, what do you know about Steve Evans, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, yeah, he's a decent, nice guy, nice fellow, and met him and boom, boom, boom. And he says he's in for the job. And so I said, well, John, it's your shout, isn't it? Boom, it's up to you. He got the job at Boston. Eventually, and then he did reasonably well, and then we had that scandal with what went on with him and Gary Hill, who was at Dagenham and Redbridge. They were scrapping for the league, and there was also, and eventually I think Boston won the league, went into the league, and all the kind of stuff you all know what happened. And Steve has been very resilient and he's done really, really well, but he's never produced a team against me that's ever beaten us, because he was at Boston, he's come to Nuneaton. And he used to be like a nice 3 points for us. It was a bonus game. And he once offered me £30,000 for a lad out up front called Mark McGregor, who I'd signed from Forest Green, and at the time back in the day. And I'm saying to Steve, there isn't enough sausages in Lincoln, mate, to that's going to make me part with Mark McGregor. And we went over there and played him in a game at York Street, and I played the kids, and we beat them 5-1. And we had a friendship after that, to be honest. And he's done, whatever you say about Steve Evans, he's been successful at a certain level. You know, I can't fault what he's done. He's achieved promotions. He's done really well. He's done really well.
He got the opportunity, though, didn't he? Whereas it wasn't given to you.
Yeah. Well, that's life. That's life, isn't it, Dave? That's life. I mean, I don't begrudge anything with his success that he's had. I know his wife. I've been down to his house. He used to live down in Wansford, down Peterborough way, and yeah, best of luck to him.
I'm not saying otherwise, but I think for all the reasons that we've discussed, there's a reason why he perhaps gets that.
No, of course.
There's a systemic issue with English football. I'm not saying necessarily a problem, but right the way down the leagues, English managers are not being given an opportunity.
No, they're not.
Because we've got this obsession with going abroad. Now, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. But if English managers are having a problem getting work, then black English managers are having an even bigger problem getting work.
Absolutely, and it ain't a great place to be in. And you're so right, Dave. It's so right, because you know you look at your television after every game, and if you don't talk with a foreign accent as a manager, you're not cool. You're not hip. And there's so many good English managers and coaches, and black and white, that deserve that opportunity to be there. But we've turned away from that 20 years now. We've turned away from that. If you're not called Maurizio this or Serginio this or whatever else you are, you don't have that opportunity at the elite level. And that's why it's always great to see what people like Eddie Howe has done at Newcastle, establish them as genuine top four, top six contenders, when everybody thought, well, as soon as the money comes in, Eddie's going to get the elbow and some Serginio, somebody else, or whatever's going to come in. The English people, British people, find it difficult to land these top jobs, don't they?
They do indeed. And coming back to you, Dave Bowler, just backtracking to a little earlier in the conversation and Brenton's experiences as a young player in the Midlands scene, the citing the excellence of the likes of Cunningham and Regis and so on. The Midlands had a vibrancy, really, for black footballers in the 1970s that was kind of unmatched as far as English football is concerned.
It's interesting. I was rereading a bit of the Bill and David's book earlier on, and there was a piece in there about one of the guys talking about the Midlands being a very unwelcoming place to black people in general in the 60s. Of course, in Smethwick, there was a famous election in 64. God knows how Smethwick could ever vote for a Conservative. I mean, Dad was born in Smethwick. I know Smethwick like the back of my hand. There's no way Smethwick should be having a Conservative. But anyway, that's by the way. I was born in 64, and I remember sort of growing up through that period, late 60s, early 70s as a kid. And there was that side to that area, no question about it. And then, you get Laurie Cunningham turn up in 77 at the Albion. Cyril a few months later, Brendan a few months after that. And this is West Bromwich Albion, which is, you can walk to Smethwick minutes from the Albion ground. And this place is suddenly pioneering this black football thing, having had this stain on the area in 1964. I mean, it's an extraordinary turnaround.
Absolutely, mate.
I'm absolutely sure this is Royston's expectable, but I don't remember the Albion crowd particularly booing, even Bob Aisley and George Berry playing for the Wolves now. That's something.
Well,
I'm sure I'm not remembering that properly, but I do remember in Alfred's Lane before games, the National Front trying to recruit and at the one end of AlphaTauri. At the other end of AlphaTauri, it was the anti-Nazi League coming up to get after the National Front. I remember that near the back end of the 70s. So I mean, it was a kind of a crucible, I suppose, of all the stuff that was going on at that point.
But marvelous stories.
Albion was just particularly lucky with Laurie and Cyril, that they were just so incredibly exciting and talented and in the same team, and that inadvertently, I suppose, made a big statement.
Oh, marvelous stories. And I can resonate with some of that because my formative years were in Coventry, which is not too far away. What happened was this scene was happening with Laurie and all them, and in Coventry it was like it turned to music, and it all resonated. And my cousin was one of the founding members and players in the Specials, mm-hmm. Linval Golden, who used to play lead guitar in there. And you know, the Coventry scene at that time was all about the two-tone and stuff like that, and the Trojan music and everything else. And it sort of spilled over into the football and a wee bit. It brought people closely together in that area in Coventry, and it spread across the country, because, you know, the two-tone and the Trojan label became synonymous with that period of time. And I don't know if you can see on here, I've got something on, which is a T-shirt, which is a Trojan label T-shirt. And Trojan was the music that brought people together back in them awful days when the racism and everything was taking hold. And it did spill into football, and it helped.
Bill, Trojan Records, I think you might be able to drag us back to the Windrush, mightn't you, with the reference?
Yeah, I can actually give you a direct link between the Windrush and Trojan Records.
Wow.
The father of the co-founder of Trojan Records was an Indian Jamaican who was on board the Windrush, and his son, Lee Gopthal, was a joint founder of Trojan Records along with Chris Blackwell. So he obviously, Chris Blackwell went on to, you know, massive success. And
Island Records, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Lee, I think, became an accountant and died some years ago. But yeah, he was co-founder of Trojan. I mean, one other thing you reminded me of, Brenton, when you signed for Coventry City as a boy, really, you were 16, I think.
Yeah.
There were headlines in the local papers that a coloured person had signed for Coventry.
I remember it, yeah.
Not normally a 16-year-old signing for Coventry would not be headline news. And it got so silly, didn't it? Because Noel Cantwell had to explain that just because I bought, and I'll use the language of the day, just because I bought a coloured player or signed a coloured player doesn't mean I'm going to employ coloured scouts. So the inference being that to spot coloured players, you needed to have coloured scouts.
I can remember it very well, because we went up, we had a schoolboy tour. Coventry boys went and played up in the northeast, and we played against Yarrow and a couple of teams up there. And I played, you know, for Coventry boys, and Newcastle United. Joe Harvey was the manager at the time. He expressed a massive interest in signing me for Newcastle back in there. I didn't even know where Newcastle was, to be honest with you. And when I got back to Coventry, that's when I got the shout from Coventry City to go on to schoolboy forms and go, you know, would you come and sign for us? Because they'd obviously got wind of the fact that on this tour up there that Newcastle were showing some interest in a couple, not just myself, a couple of the Coventry boys team. So that's where that came about. And I can remember the headline, City signed coloured player in the Evening Telegraph, I think, or something like that. And it was quite strange, but you never thought anything of it, because that was the language of the day, Bill.
You do know if you'd signed for Newcastle, I would never have spoken to you.
You'd never have spoken. But that was the language of the day. And it was like, it's you know, you think back now and after all these years, and you really have some experiences, and it's great to talk to guys like yourselves who have had this interest. You've done your research, you've done all of this kind of stuff, and you put it out there. It's out there, and you guys should all be commended, mate, because at the end of the day, these kind of things can only help. It can only help.
Yeah, can I just go back to Dave's point about geographically where the early black players were? Because prior to Viv Anderson playing for England, the press was full of information about, you know, who might be the first black player to play. And people were writing into newspapers to say, I can actually pick a team of black players. And somebody did write in, and oddly enough, he said, I can't think of a goalkeeper. So the rest of the team would have been Viv Anderson, Brendan Batson, George Burry, Bob Hazel, Ricky Hill, Phil Walker, Laurie Cunningham.
Oh, definitely.
Gary Thompson, another Midlander, Coventry. Cyril Regis, Garth Crooks, and the substitutes, Luther Blissett, Vince Hilaire, and John Chidozie.
Yeah, what a player.
They were
the early guys. And you just, I mean, of all those, Laurie and Vince Hilaire. I mean, I played against Vince Hilaire when he was at Palace for Leicester Reserves. He used to play Palace. What a player. Laurie Cunningham at Orient, what a player. And so on, you know, and you just look back, and they're great names. They're all pioneers. They were the guys, weren't they? You know, George Berry and then Bob Hazel, big bruising centre-halves, did a job. Great player, great days, mate.
I think that's the great thing is that for white individuals our age, you know, and I go from kind of like, you know, knocking on the door to 50, you know, as the youngest probably of our little clientele here, is that, you know, we hold these players with such reverence. And, you know, it has that domino effect, is that, you know, we are of a certain thought process and a certain generation that now questions, you know, why black individuals do not make it into managerial positions, do not make it into executive roles. And that generation and the names that Bill's just reeled off there, you know, it ties into what I was saying to Dave before as well, in that so many of them came from the Midlands and Midlands clubs. You know, Stoke City, you know, with both George Berry, Garth Crooks, another one. You know, there's always, they're on that bizarre periphery of are they in the North or are they in the Midlands? But, you know, they tie into that, I don't know, that rise of the Midlands as well.
Marvellous times, love them. And great guys, I'm really, really... been so enlightening tonight. It really has.
Brendan, I might want to enlighten you a little bit more. You mentioned Don Gardner. Now, not many people remember Don Gardner, so it was nice that you recalled him. He was actually Wolverhampton Wanderers' first black player. And you're right, he only played, I think, one full game and two substitute games. And then he went off to America, where he had, I think, quite a successful career. What happened was there's evidence that he was bullied in the dressing room. Some racist abuse, and perhaps he just wasn't resilient or strong enough, I don't know. But George Burry witnessed it, and George Burry vowed when he saw it happen, he said, I'm never going to let anybody treat me that way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the fact he was 6'6" and everything probably helped, but I think it probably helped George Burry's career, because he thought, I'm not going to put up with that, I'm going to fight it.
Seriously, Bill, that's really good to know that Don had a career, because when you're sort of playing it, he used to kick off at 11 o'clock or something on a Saturday morning, Leicester City 18 versus Wolverhampton 18, and you see a talent, this black guy. And for me, at that point, he was very, very top draw material. You always thought that this kid's going to go and make it. It didn't really make it at Wolves that big. But to know now, after all these years, because you never forget people that make an impression on you, and even as a youngster, to know that Don went to America and had some kind of career, really, really pleased for that. I don't know if he's still around or not, but he, for me, was in my time of signing for Leicester City back in those days. There was Don Gardner at Wolves, Viv was at Forest at that point, and I can't really remember too many other black players that I used to come up against at that point in my early career. And he was a lovely guy. He was a really nice guy. I remember talking to Don a few times after games, and he was a really nice guy. Yeah, I remember him.
Wonderful, wonderful. Brenton, moving on to some of the names that you you passed in your career along the way, you know, the mention of Noel Campbell there and Joe Harvey, you know, showing an interest in you, but, you know, you come across some incredible names. Peter Taylor at Brighton. for listeners, that's the you know, the one that was so synonymous with Brian Clough rather than the Tottenham winger of later years, you know, Alan Mullery, Howard Wilkinson with England C, 8 caps won. The impressions that you had of some of these characters and the roles that they played across your career.
Well, I mean, yeah, they're all names that are up there, aren't they? I mean, you know, I don't have too much, you know. Howard Wilkinson was the manager of the England non-league squad, and Howard was fantastic tactically. Knew the game. His brain, football brain, was immense. And I know people have this thing about, oh, well, he's a typical structured FA man, but it was brilliant to work with Howard Wilkinson. Some managers, you know, you resonate with them, and Howard was really great at telling you where to go, what to do, what not to do. Stand still sometimes, you get more of the ball. Don't go running around like a chicken with no head on and that kind of stuff. And he was really good at that. And I love the sessions that he used to put on with Howard Wilkinson. Was fantastic. We used to really look forward to those. Peter Taylor, I didn't really know him that well. He wanted to sign me for Brighton and Hove Albion when he was down there. I'd agreed everything. Then they went off to Forest and then Alan Mullery took over. I don't have really any fond memories of working with Alan Mullery because he sort of didn't reneged on the contract that was put on in front of me because he didn't know me, and that was rightly, that was his choice. I stayed down there for 3 months, but I'd given up everything in Leicester, my flat, my job and everything else to go down there, and then I had to start again, and that's where the need and experience came in. But all these other names that you've mentioned, they've all got, you know, good things about them, and I've learned a bit of every one of them. But in terms of motivational managers, it was Graham Carr at Dunedin, who was immensely motivational. He made you feel as if you were never going to get beat when you went out of that dressing room at Manor Park and or anywhere. He was fantastic, and I love my time with Graham. You know, it's you. I try to think that in my managerial career that you try and use a little bit of everything from them, from the ones that you. Some of them I wouldn't even would use nothing from, but you know, likes of Graham and you know Howard's tactical nails and people like that. Yeah, they made an impression on me. They really did, Steve. And even to this day, I get videos out and I still think and I look at things and I think, well, you know, Howard was doing that or Graham told us to do that 20 odd years ago, and they're still doing it now. I mean, Graham Carr, I watch football these days and nobody ever puts people on the post anymore. He always used to say, one on the front stick, one on the back stick, when you set it up against corners, always, religiously. And nobody does it these days. And I think, well, why are they not doing that? Because how many goals do you see that somebody puts the ball in and knock it into the near post, somebody scores a header, there's nobody there. Because they say, well, they're all marking space. Carr used to say, never tell me about space because I've never seen space score a goal in my life. Did you know what I mean? But they all mark space or areas or whatever now, don't they? And they've made the game, you know, running through the lines and whatever else they go on with now. And you think to yourself, is that pressing or is that making a run in the channel or, you know, false nine? And they've made the games... A false nine, a number nine, when I played football, used to be a big 6 foot geezer with a bent nose who played against a big 6 foot centre half with an equally bent nose. They'd bash the hell out of each other for 90 minutes. One could score goals and one could stop goals. That was a definition of a number nine and a number five. But nowadays, you get people at number five, they run out and they pass it back to them. Pass it back and they get it off the keeper and it on you. And you've got to be an ardent football fan to stick watching all that kind of stuff because it's so slow. It's like playing on a Saturday morning, a training session, isn't it?
It certainly can be. It certainly can be. And to the two Daves and Bill, I'll throw Howard Wilkinson back out there for some analysis. I mean, you know, Brenton has made a glowing mention of him there. And you know, he's someone that does get a bit of a, you know, the rough end of the stick in a similar way to how Graham Taylor used to get it. But, you know, as far as Black players were concerned, you know, there's a manager who's quite groundbreaking himself. You know, he built a Leeds United title winning side that had two Black players in central defence and Chris Fairclough and Chris White. He had Chris Kamara as part of his promotion winning squad, and you know, and there was the signing of Rod Wallace and Ray Wallace as well.
Yes,
you know, Howard Wilkinson, the two Daves and Bill, anyone can run with that.
Howard Wilkinson had a bad spell at Sunderland, so my personal experience of him was negative. But it's a very interesting comparison with Graham Taylor, because until I spoke to people who'd worked with Graham Taylor or watched Watford, you know, regularly, I hadn't realised how good Graham Taylor was and what a legend he is in Watford. I mean, he is absolutely adored. And when Brenton was telling me about Howard Wilkinson's training, his methods, his analytical brain, clearly had a lot of talent. And, you know, OK, you can't succeed everywhere. He didn't do well at Sunderland. But, yeah, what he's achieved is absolutely incredible.
For somebody who seems the archetypal old-fashioned English kind of manager, I mean, I saw a lot of Chris White when he played at the Albion. Chris White was the least typical English centre-half that you could get, a more laid-back centre-half. You couldn't imagine. And he was great on the ball. You know, he passed it out from the back. He always had loads and loads of time to play. Now, that's not a big plank of a centre-half that you're thinking of. And that was, you know, he was one of the mainsprings of that Edward Wilkinson Leeds team that won the league. And Edward's still the last Englishman to win the league. And I think he'll be holding that title for quite a while to come.
Absolutely, absolutely. Brenton, I've held off for about an hour and a quarter from asking the big question. 1988, Aylesbury versus England. You have the floor.
I'm still struggling for breath. And how many years ago was that? And I mean, the story was like, it was a fabulous story. And I'll touch on it at the beginning. Charlie Docker, the chair. And we played the England team, and it was full of absolute superstars of the day. I think they were one of the big favourites going into that tournament. Was it Germany they were going to?
It was, yes. Some
tournament. And they were staying down at Bisham Abbey, which weren't too far away from Aylesbury, really. And I think Bobby Robson was just looking for a run out and bit of a competitive type game to keep the lads ticking over before they flew out to Germany. And Trevor Gould, you know, called us all back in, and we just could not believe it. As players, we were playing against England and went down to Buckingham Road, and everybody was 7,000-8,000 people that turned up and packed into the ground. The bus came, the England bus turned up, and do you know what, guys? They were so down to earth. It was absolutely fabulous. Played this game and we couldn't get near them. And Peter Beardsley, what a magician. I think it was 7-7 or something like that. But after the game, they came into the bar area, and I remember getting Kenny. I got Glenn Addle's shirt, Kenny Sampson's shirt, and one other. They were so generous giving souvenirs out to the players and stuff. And Bobby Robson came in. He was an absolute gentleman. They stayed. They had something to eat with us, and it was probably one of the best days of my entire football life. Just to be around these players, Gary Lineker, they were all, it was just like an amazing day. we were all, after about half an hour, I've never seen lads with their tongues hanging out because you just couldn't get near, you could not get near anybody. They just murdered us. And yet they went to this tournament and didn't do anything, did they? They never did anything, which was, we thought, well, they're gonna win that comfortable. That, how good can players be at that level? They can't be much better than them. We never made an impression, did we? But no, it was a great memories, fabulous memories, and things that you'll cherish forever. I will anyway, and I know we're still in touch with some the Aylesbury lads from back in the day, Cliff Campbell and a few others, and Gary Artin and Cliff Hercules and some of these guys, you know. And every time we have a conversation or meet up, we talk about that game. And we always say, well, how could Trev do that to us? We hadn't even had any training. But Charlie must have banked about 30 grand that day. That's why he did it.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic memories. Oh, so thank you. Thank you so much, Brenton, for sparing us the time to come and talk to us about your experiences.
No, that's absolutely fine. It's been my absolute pleasure, guys.
Thank you so much, Brenton.
Thank you ever so much, fellas. And it's been fabulous being part of this. Thank you all.
Oh, the wonderful, wonderful Brenton Phillips there for us. Moving away from all things Brenton, though, Bill and David, Windrush, we've done this with several of most of the episodes. Give us the list of legends. Give us the ones that fall under the radar that people should know about and maybe don't. The floor is yours.
I thought what Brenton was saying there was gave us a nice little lead into Lloyd Maitland at Huddersfield. I know that Bill mentioned Lloyd earlier. He also played against an England 11. I mean, he was with Huddersfield and he played, I think Huddersfield had won the Youth Cup, I think, the year before. And in those days, it was tradition for the winners of the Youth Cup to play a England Youth 11. And so Lloyd Maitland represented Huddersfield against an England Youth 11. Brian Robson, for instance, was in that England team. Was perhaps the most noticeable name. I mean, Lloyd Maitland, I think, is worth mentioning. Was he one of the ones that was born in Jamaica, or was he born over here, Bill? Sorry, my memory's going.
Yeah, he was born over here. His dad came across in 1951. His dad was a chauffeur in Jamaica for quite a wealthy family. And he came across as a bus driver in Birmingham. So, Dave, you were kind of referring to the people who came across to the NHS, yeah, the transport system and so on. Classic Windrush material because, he took a second job. He worked incredibly hard. Eventually, he'd earn enough to buy a house. The house had four floors, so they lived on the bottom floor. He rented out the top three floors. So they slowly built up their wealth. He married a white lady, and Lloyd did tell me that his mother suffered a lot of racist abuse for being in a mixed marriage. And certainly when Lloyd was old enough to sign for a football team, he just wanted to get out of Birmingham. He really didn't like it there. And he went to Huddersfield, and he found Huddersfield to be a lot more tolerant. Yeah, he did brilliantly. I mean, Huddersfield had the best youth team they've ever had. Lloyd had a trial for England youth, and he said he felt it was a bit cliquish, which I guess, I mean, that could be to do with the fact that he was playing for Huddersfield and there weren't any other Huddersfield players in the squad, whereas the others might have been, you know, two or three from Spurs, two or three from Chelsea, whatever. But a few players have mentioned this to me, that they've said, well, the passes just seem to be a little bit short, or the tackles were much harder than with other players. Now, whether that's factual, whether that's imagination, I don't know, but a few players have said that. But yeah, Lloyd, I mean, just jumping on to his career, did very well at Huddersfield, went to Darlington, and his career was ended at a very, very young age, a really tragic tale. It was the close season, and he was out with some teammates from Darlington, and they'd had a day out in Harrogate. He tells me drink wasn't involved, and they were driving back to home, and they had to pull over. He needed to relieve himself, so he got out of the car. And the teammates thought this would be really funny. Wanted to drive off and leave him, this country lane, middle of nowhere. So they drove off, and Lloyd thought, well, what do I do? So he decided to start walking. And just as he got to the brow of a hill, his teammates came back to collect him. But of course, they hit him, smashed his legs, bundled him into the car, took him to Harrogate Hospital, left him at the door, and drove off. Lloyd never played again. He was on the verge of signing for Sunderland. Sunderland clearly didn't want him any longer now that his career was over. He never, you know, as I say, he never played again. But what a lovely man. He's got a great family. He became a plasterer. And there didn't seem to be any bitterness or resentment there. But he was quite a typical Windrush family, really.
I think that's one of the things that illustrates. I mean, Bill, I think, alluded to it earlier. When we set out on this book, we thought, well, we're going to come up with 92 stories. It's going to be a bit boring. It's going to be, here's a black player. Oh, he played for this team. Move on. But actually, I mean, the 92 stories are just so different. And Lloyd Maitland, you couldn't really come across, I think Bill used the word tragic. I mean, you couldn't come across much of a sadder story than that as a way to end a football career. So, I mean, Lloyd Maitland, I think, is should be better remembered than he is in football. And I'm so glad that Bill, I know, has spoken to him a few times and that he's led a happy life.
He actually got introduced to the crowd in a Huddersfield game last season, so he certainly is being remembered again. And I'm finding that with quite a few of the early Black players, the crowds now. I mean, Cannavale, Paul Cannavale's a classic example. Chelsea support was used to boo him, and now he's absolutely idolised. You know, if he's got a suite named after him at Stamford Bridge, massive character in the Chelsea setup. So I think people are, well, remorseful or forgiving or whatever, but certainly they're giving the players the credit that they should have had in the early days.
I mean, Dave Bowler, I mean, these are stories that are, long overdue, but good to hear.
They are, and I think you've got to give credit to the different generations that have come in into the game. There are, I suppose, as Bill said, remorseful for the way that some of these guys are treated in the past, and are trying to put it right. And I still think football clubs don't do anywhere near enough to mark these stories, actually to mark any of the history. But that's a whole different kettle of fish. But no, I mean, I think that a lot of people, it's different generations that are in charge of these sorts of things now. It's difficult at the minute because, you kind of feel that society's moved on, and you kind of think that we're better than we were in the 1970s, and then you look at some of the other things that are going on with, we're obsessed with small boats and I don't know, supposedly bringing the country down. I don't know how that's happening, but and you think, well, have we moved? I don't know. Perhaps we haven't. It's a very weird sort of mix of things that's going on at the minute. And I think a dangerous time in a sense, in the same way it was a dangerous time in the mid 1970s, because it could go either way,
Bill and David, valid points there from Dave. I think my take on that is that I know people who are, I don't know, socially conscious, I've just got better at being socially conscious and I don't know, learning from history. But it still doesn't stop there being a thread of society that are still stuck in very, very startlingly similar ways to the 70s and further back and even in between.
I think that's one of the things Bill and I discussed when we started thinking about the book and started to write the chapters of the book. Basically, I think we could see that things, there was a danger that things were going to go backwards. Because I mean, I think, I share your views that things, genuinely did get better, I think, in the 1990s, certainly compared to the 70s and 80s. But I think perhaps it was coincidence, perhaps it wasn't. But I mean, I think the Brexit referendum seemed to change the atmosphere, and suddenly there became this loathing of all things foreign, which is sort of reaching crescendo now with, as Dave mentioned, the kind of the small boats panic, which is largely manufactured, and is of government's own creation. I'm risking getting a bit political here, so I'll shut up. But broadly speaking, I think we can see things going backwards, and that's what we were worried about when we started to write the book. We wanted to say there's some really important history here that people need to understand and know about in order to help try and stop us from going backwards.
I think that's an interesting point, though, David, that it's government constructed, and that was different in the 1970s. Because I mean, yeah, we had the National Front, and obviously there's all that stuff going on. But you think of Enoch Powell, it ended up being driven out of the Conservative Party. It wasn't an acceptable thing within government. I mean, these are ridiculously archaic terms now, but we had the Race Relations Board and all of that sort of stuff to come in to try and deal with these issues and to try to improve things. And I think you're right. I think it's a different landscape now. Wherever your politics, I think there's not that same imperative on either side of the two main political parties to do something about it. I think there's a willingness to harness the discontent for their own benefits which we didn't see in the 1970s, for all their faults on either side.
All excellent and valid points. Gentlemen, it has been another wonderful and enlightening evening. And Brenton brought so much, so much joy to the podcast as well. We have one episode left to go. This has been our penultimate episode of Black Pioneers series in celebration of Black History Month, which, you know, we do have to nod that, you know, it's a double-sided coin, Black History Month. It's something that has to happen, but we should live in a society where it doesn't need to happen. But, you know, gentlemen, once again, thank you so much for all your contributions. Dave Bowler, it's been a wonderful, wonderful podcast again.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. I was right at the start. It has been better than all the others. No, it hasn't really. I mean, they've all been fantastic, actually. I mean, you know, they have. So much from, you know, from Bill, from David, and from all the guests that we've had so far. So we need to end on a big finish for the next one.
Yes, we do indeed. And mentioning our spirit guides, Bill Hearn and David Gleave, thank you so much for all the knowledge that you've brought to this recording tonight.
Pleasure as ever.
Thank you, and I enjoyed so much listening to Brenton. I know Bill has met him. I never have. It was very, very enjoyable.
Oh, it was indeed. All that leaves me today is to say is thank you for listening, and please do join us for part five, our final episode of our Black Pioneers series. This has been a podcast from These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.